Good morning and welcome to Successful Investing with me, Jack Monteith, and my business partner, Ken Smith. This is a show that is going to help you build wealth, protect wealth, and to enjoy the fruits of your success. Ken and I have a combined 40 years of experience in the financial world. We're both owners in two wealth management firms, Empirical Wealth Management and Directional Financial Services. We're both certified financial planners. I'm a CPA and Ken has a master's degree in financial analysis. The point is, we're going to help you navigate through all of the noise and endless investment choices to become successful investors. We do encourage your questions and ideas for discussion topics in the future, so visit our website at www.directionalfs.com or email us at contact@directionalfs.com. And you can certainly call us at 877-262-9330.
We encourage you to give us a call with any questions you have about the radio show or topics we discuss. And also, we are financial advisors through our company, Directional Financial Services. We help clients invest who have a minimum of $30,000 or more. And we're happy to talk to you about what we do and how we can help you implement some of the techniques and strategies that we talk about here on the show.
Ken, let's talk about this morning. I received a copy of a investment wealth alert advertisement or paper from one of my clients. And it's one of those that, you know, you've received or many of our clients received. It has big headlines such as darkness at noon in Beijing. China is about to unleash $486 billion to a short list of connected companies.
Wow.
The secrets of profits. Grab your share of this $184 billion pot, the largest, most profitable, fast-moving boom in history.
Wow.
You know, on and on and on. How you can turn pennies into fortunes.
It sounds pretty exciting,
John. Oh, yeah, just send them $995 and they'll make you an instant millionaire. Well, our industry, we know that's, you know, most if not all of this kind of stuff is pure nonsense. And where our research has shown that the passive approach or the index approach is far superior to any of these get-rich kind of gimmicks. Could you describe to our listeners what we mean by passive?
Yeah, and I think for us, Jack, and what we do day to day, we differentiate between gambling and investing, right?
I mean,
we don't believe in, you know, these newsletters, these trading techniques that you hear, the call to buy gold and these things you hear on the radio advertisements all the time. These basically get rich quick schemes, and we think investing in the stock and bond markets around the world, you know, you can treat it as a casino or a place of gambling if you want to, and it's unfortunate that a lot of professional advisors out there encourage people to hire them to treat it as a casino, and our view of that, and we can talk about that a little bit, is, you know, somebody who's picking a handful of stocks with this idea that they've come up with a technique to figure out how to outperform the rest of the market because they have some skill or knowledge of what's going to happen to these companies in advance. And if you could only tap into their brilliance, right, then you can become a millionaire too.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous in our opinion. It's garbage. The stuff you see, half the stuff you see on some of the financial channels that we won't mention specifics as shows people screaming and buy and this and that. It's all a bunch of garbage in our opinion. And so the way we, you know, talking about a passive approach, we're buy and hold. We're buy and hold advisors. We're buy and hold investors ourselves. We think that you want to build a portfolio that meets your time horizon, your goals. We've talked about on the show understanding your goals and values and those things, and a mix of stocks and bonds, and then diversify them. You know, own the entire market if you have to.
Well, let's, you know, oftentimes there's confusion on owning the market, and a lot of people think that just owning the S&P 500 is diversification. And, you know, I know that it's much broader than that. I mean, we literally invest into the world economies. You know, it's a point now where the U.S. economy is only 28% of the world economy, so it makes sense to completely diversify among the world. So, Ken, can you describe a little bit, and let's go back to square one and describe exactly what a passive or an index approach is.
I'd be glad to, Jack. An index fund simply tracks the performance or seeks to mirror the stocks that are in a segment of the market. And so, for example, the S&P 500 is one of the more popular indexes. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is an index that you hear quoted all the time as to a barometer of how the market's doing. You know, the problem with that index is it has a small number of stocks. You know, it's less than 40 stocks, about 30 stocks in that index, where the S&P 500 gives you 500 stocks, and it does it on a capitalization-weighted basis. So it looks at how big a company is, and it determines its size in the index of in proportion to how big it is relative to the other companies. So if you owned those largest 500 American companies and you did it in proportion to their size, you would control or own about 75% of the available market in the United States. You know, you don't have a vast majority of the market. And so what happens is you have these indices that are set up, and then you have mutual fund companies, which are companies that go out and take a big pool of investors' money, put it into one investment, and then they go out and buy all 500 stocks that are in that index. And they do their very best to track the performance, to get you the performance of that index. And if it's a really good fund, they'll get as close to the performance of that with the least amount of drag from their expenses as possible.
Well, how do you counter the argument that you see advertisements quite often about mutual funds, and they tout that they've beaten the S&P 500, or they're rated five stars, or on and on?
Right. And, you know, this has been a huge element of confusion that I want to continue to drive home as we have the show. You know, there all the studies that have been done, we have a list. If you go to our website, www.directionalfs.com, go into the resource section. We have a list of reading materials and books that we recommend. And in those books, most of which are written by academics, not written by people who work for brokerage firms or investment banking companies, you'll see a list of studies. And all those studies show the same thing, that, you know, on average, most of the managers out there, and I don't care what sector of the market we're talking about, don't beat buying an index fund. And so in a random chance, if you put mutual fund managers, and now there's over, you know, probably 15, 20,000 mutual funds available out there, in a statistical, just a random test, you put them all in a bucket and pick names, you would expect at least a portion of them to outperform, right? Just randomly, you would expect a portion. But what you find is that in most studies, you know, you have only about a third that would outperform that S&P 500 index if we looked at the large companies of America, and you looked at how managers investing in that pool did. Only about a third of them beat it, and you'd expect that in just a random statistical drawing, right?
Right.
The problem is there's not a lot of consistency with these winners. When they do beat the market, and you finally get the advertisement in your Money Magazine, the top 10 list, or you see the commercial of one of these actively managed fund companies touting their five-star performance, the problem I have is they very rarely stay in the top performance in the subsequent years. And our
I think the statistics show that, you know, the active managers have actually beaten the S&P 500 over a 10-year period, you literally could count in two hands. I mean, it's 10 or so. It's a very minute number.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Ken, now, so we're talking about the the United States economy being 28% of the world economy. So how does the typical investor, you know, other than coming to advisors such as ourselves, how does that investor participate in the rest of the world? Do they go out and pick individual stocks, or do they find a mutual fund? What would your opinion be the best way to participate in the world economy?
Well, there are asset allocation funds out there, Jack, that enable you to, with a very small number of investments, control or have exposure to the entire world economy. I mean, you can buy, and I would encourage investors to go to Vanguard's website. They're a mutual fund company started back in the 70s. They came up with the very first S&P 500 index, and they're very unique in that unlike many of most of the mutual fund companies out there, they're owned by the investors. They're a private company, but the way that they're structured is that the shareholders own. So they have consistently lowered costs and expenses in their funds as they increase their assets. So very unique company, but they also have a whole line of mutual funds that are in diversified indexes. And some of these funds are what are called asset allocation funds, where with one investment, they'll own companies and indices from all around the world in all different sectors of the market. Now, I think what we do that's unique for investors that come and work with us is even at Vanguard and what's available on the retail market, they don't capture all the unique little areas that we like to get exposure to, that we think some of the academics have proven makes sense to include in a portfolio. But that's a great approach for probably, 90% of the people out there who are starting out investing, is to look at these, and there's a couple different kinds. There's the kinds that buy a particular mix of stocks and bonds from all around the world, and they hold that mix, say a 60% stock, 40% bond. And then there are these life strategy funds now, or these target retirement funds out there. And if you go to the Vanguard website and you go into their asset allocation funds, you'll see that they have a combination of both of those. And those funds basically have target maturity dates on them that somebody would be retiring. And so there might be the 2025 fund. And what would happen is if you bought that fund now, as you progress closer to that retirement date, the fund adjusts its risk levels or its exposure to growth or stock type assets that are aggressive. It becomes more and more conservative as that time frame occurs.
Well, now we're talking stocks, and as clients come to us and our existing clients, first what we want to do is find out what their goals and objectives are and what their time frame is. And often the case is the portfolio is a mix of stocks and bonds, and a very common allocation might be 60% stocks through the passive index approach and then 40% bonds. You often hear the comments that, it's better off for individuals to own the actual individual bonds versus bonds through a fund. Oftentimes we'll see new clients coming into us with existing maybe 10 or 12 or even fewer bonds.
Right.
So how do we address the issue of, is it better to go with individual bonds versus maybe an index of bond funds?
Right. Well, Jack, what's interesting is if you look at these studies, you need diversification in bonds, and our approach to the bond part of a portfolio is, and the research that was done, a guy by the name of James Tobin did some research back in 1958, and subsequently he won a Nobel Prize. And one of the things that he said is, hey, if you're going to have fixed income in your portfolio, you want to have it there to reduce volatility. Because we know over long periods of time, if you were to look at 30-year chunks of time, it's about 99% of the 30-year periods going back to the 1800s, stocks have returned on an inflation-adjusted basis a higher rate of return than bonds do, right? So the primary reason someone has bonds is they, in their portfolio as they progress, is they want to reduce the year-over-year risk, that those huge swings that you get with stocks. You can be down 30%, even in a very diversified stock portfolio that owns these index funds we're talking about and giving you exposure all over the world, you're still going to have, once every 30 years or so, the potential to be down 30% in a particular year.
Well, such as the year 2000, 2001, and 2002. That was a prime example.
Yeah, it was. The S&P dropped, more than 30% from the top to the bottom.
I believe it was almost 44%.
Right. So the bonds, getting back to that, Jack, your question is, what do we do with these bonds? And, if they're there for stability of the portfolio, and we see a lot of investors make mistakes when it comes to the bond section of their portfolio, if they're there to reduce the volatility, what you want to do is have bonds that are relatively short in maturity. When we construct portfolios, we don't go more than 5 years, as you know. And there's a lot of research as to why you do that. You just don't get paid for the interest rate risk that, you incur when you hold bonds that are longer in maturity.
But can most people, a good portion of people will buy bonds based on the yield or how much interest they're paying. And we see that over and over again.
Yeah, they stretch to get that extra 0.5% or 1% yield, and they forget about the reason the bonds are in the portfolio. And perfect example, there's a popular brokerage firm that has was supposed to be a very conservative bond fund that's dropped about 17% over the last year from its top to bottom. And this is a fund that wasn't supposed to have much more volatility, supposedly, than a money market, somewhere between a very short-term corporate bond fund or a regular bond fund and a money market. Most people wouldn't expect to see their bond fund decline 70%. Now, how did they make that mistake? Well, they're trying to get a better yield, and so they did not include government bonds, U.S. government bonds, in the portfolio. mostly corporate bonds. And it happened to be that a good portion of those corporate bonds were exposed to one sector of the economy, and that happened to be one that was affected by the mortgage problems that we're having.
Right.
So when the unexpected does happen, and I think what all of our investors need to realize is there are no free lunches out there. You know, risk is intertwined with return. Now, there are things you can do, however, to avoid unnecessary risk, and we'll talk about that. So stretching to get an extra 0.5% of yield out of a bond fund that drops 17%, right? How many years is it going to take now if that bond fund just does what it was supposed to do?
Right.
And there's no reason to expect that it's not like it's going to go back up 17%. Those bonds, that fund went from about $13 billion down to $2.5 billion, right? So they had to sell. Those bonds are gone. It's not we're going to hold on and it's going to come back.
Well, another risk that I see that's a lot of times is not understood for the individual that goes out and buys a portfolio of bonds, and maybe that's 10 bonds or maybe it's 5 bonds or 20 bonds.
Right.
And they go out and they do a good job, they buy good quality, they're paying a decent interest rate, and they're buying, and maybe they're 10 years out or 20 years out or even longer. The risk they have is today's environment is a pretty low interest paying environment. The risk is lost opportunity. Interest rates will not always be this low. So if you're locking yourself into a 10, 20 year period at a moderate to low interest rate, what you've done is you've locked yourself into lost opportunities.
That's right. That's right. And, as you mentioned, the interest rates, I think we're at we're teetering around a 40 year low on interest rates at this point. And, they can only go down to zero, right? But they can go up, and we've seen, at times they've gone up into the high double digits of interest rates. So, you have to get this bond component right, and I think what we're saying is keep the maturity short, and then diversify just like you diversify with stocks. You diversify. You don't just own 10 or 20 bonds. You make sure that you've got a portfolio of, and we recommend buying a total bond market fund and using a combination of a short-term, with an intermediate term type of bond fund, and Vanguard has several bond index funds that do this. Mm-hmm. And those funds own U.S. government securities, they own corporate securities, they own government-backed securities, and they own them all around the world. You can buy bond funds that give you exposure all around the world.
Well, certainly, Ken, for our more affluent clients, we're able to buy indexes of bonds both in the U.S., internationally, we're able to do high rated, we're able to buy those inflation the tips.
Right. And that's something we think should be included in the portfolio. I mean, the U.S. government created the inflation adjusted bonds not too long ago.
Right.
And those are a great way to provide the income portion of the portfolio and do it on a inflation adjusted basis. So as inflation goes up in periods of right now where we have low interest rates and inflation's been relatively low, if you have those tips in your portfolio, those inflation-protected securities, you're going to be protected from rapid inflation increases.
One more question on the bonds, and what's your opinion on the high-yield bonds? They pay a much better interest rate. Do they have a place in a portfolio of bonds?
If they do, and we do include a small portion in our portfolios, but no more than 10% of the bond component. And I know a lot of advisors debate on that because since we're saying, hey, keep the bond portfolio is there for a specific reason, but the thing about the high yield is it's not perfectly correlated to the bond market, and it's not perfectly correlated to the stock market, although it doesn't has a positive correlation in the stock market.
Well, explain a little bit what a high yield is.
Well, a high yield bond is a bond that's been issued from a company that has a lower than a BBB rating from one of the major agencies out there. So Standard & Poor's has a rating where they divide between investment grade, and they classify investment grade being those higher quality companies, the companies that have a high propensity or ability to pay off their debt. And they go AAA down to AA, single A, and then you have BBB, right, as the rating. And
right.
When you get below BBB, the ratings on those are lower, and they look at those companies and say, hey, they're not as financially stable. There's a little bit more risk here with these companies that they won't be able to make payback. And historically, I think the default rate on high yield bonds has been somewhere around between 2 and 3%. So if you look at the yield, you kind of have to incorporate the fact that there's going to be a default rate in there. So when we own them, we also use one of the Vanguard funds that owns literally hundreds of bonds, not just a handful of these high-yield bonds.
Well, we personally and would never let our clients own individual high-yield bonds because you have that risk of default. And you just, one of those going default on you, like you say, it can wipe out 10 years worth of interest.
Right. So you have to know what you're doing and you have to know where they fit in. And we never put more than 10% of the bond portfolio there.
Well, we could continue with this discussion, but right now let's remind our listeners, if you have any questions or comments you'd like us to address on this show, our website is www.directionalfs.com. Email is contact@directionalfs.com or call us at 877-262-9330.
You know, Jack, this is probably a good time to mention, too, if you call us or go to our website, we'll be posting schedules of seminars, free investment seminars, and we've been doing these now for a while, and basically we're teaching you how to invest successfully. And it's hard with a short show here to cover all the material that we can get through when we have an hour or two to sit down with you in a seminar and explain how markets work, how we build a globally diversified portfolio that meets and matches with your investment objectives. So please give us a call or visit the website and sign up for one of our seminars in your local area.
Ken, probably at this time we need to, we've received a couple of questions and let's answer some of these questions.
Sure, we get questions. We've been getting questions from listeners and clients of ours. And so I've got one here, client, and this is an issue actually we've dealt with for a long time and addressed. But clients ask about annuities. Should I buy an annuity? And there's an insurance person that's approaching this particular listener of ours, and they've heard about annuities, and they want to know how should somebody buy one, Jack, and how do they fit into someone's portfolio?
Well, my first advice on if you're being approached to buy an annuity is really step back and, get a second opinion. You need to understand what the motivation of maybe the salesperson that's suggesting getting into an annuity. I mean, typically annuities are going to pay that person maybe 3 to as high as 10% commission to get into that annuity. Now, annuities can have a place, but they're so often oversold. For example, we've seen them in IRAs or retirement accounts, and that's just that's crazy. Annuities typically have high investment expenses or high internal expenses. They have a tax-deferred nature, so why would you put a tax-deferred vehicle inside a tax-deferred vehicle? We get approached by clients, or we've seen people recommending what's called variable annuities. And variable annuities are annuities that invest the proceeds into mutual funds that invest into stock markets. Again, there's a much more efficient way to own the stock market. As we've discussed, it's the index approach. Variable annuities have lots of internal expenses. The income that comes out of those annuities is ordinary income. It gets paid at your highest tax bracket versus investing directly into the market, which is only the capital gains rate. This is a topic, Ken, that we're definitely going to talk about in more detail. There are places and times for annuities, and it can work well in cash flow planning for retired folks. So it has a place there. But oftentimes it's much too oversold.
You're right. And what I've seen, and I think the most egregious misuse of annuities, as you mentioned, is, and we've seen it several times, of these salespeople putting selling an annuity that is a tax deferred vehicle into an IRA account.
Yes.
Particularly when the annuity, if it's a variable annuity or something, where they're not actually annuitizing it or drawing the income off of it, they're using it, as an investment vehicle, and you're layering all those extra expenses in there. And it very rarely, fixed annuities may make sense. Very rarely do we ever have someone put 100% of their assets into that.
Right. Well, Ken, time flies when you're having fun, and we did say we would tell it like it is, and certainly we are opinionated about annuities.
You better believe it.
That's going to wrap up our show today. So again, we really encourage your questions or thoughts or just comments. And website www.directionalfs.com or email contact at directionalfs.com. Call us at 877-262-9330. And visit us for our next show. We're going to have a guest on long-term care insurance.
Have a wonderful day.
Goodbye.